Hi, so it's another edition of Interviews with the Masters. We are live, and we have three special guests on the phone. We have Devin Leonard, Dallas Hamer, and Sawyer Peacock. And we're going to have some other guys popping in here and there, I'm sure. We're going to be talking a little bit about, adventure hunting. Hopefully diving a little bit about Ibex. And as you can see, I'm wearing my flat brim hat today, the only one that I own, because I didn't want to be left out of the crowd. And I look like a complete Momo in it. Real quick before I get these guys on here, just want to give special thanks to Onyx Maps and my title sponsor, the Outdoor Insiders. Go give them a check. Check them out on the outdoorinsiders.com. All right, so guys, let's. Well, I'm going to start with you, Dallas. Why don't you give me a little bit about yourself, and just give me a little couple liner bio about you, so our listeners know who we're talking to.
Cool. My name is Dallas Haymeyer. I am 24 years old. I live in Utah. I am married. I got two little boys, and for about the last year and a half now, I have been a full-time videographer and photographer in the hunting industry.
Awesome. And Sawyer, to go for
it. Yeah, for sure. I kind of followed Dallas's story, except I'm not the full-time videographer and photographer. 23 years old, got a kid and another one on the way. I live up in northern Utah, and I buy antlers for a living. So I get to do that, and then in hunting season, I just chase all these goofy kids around and have fun with them.
Awesome. And last but not least, Devin Leonard, how are you?
Doing good, John. How are you?
Good, man. Can't complain.
Good.
Enjoying the nice weather.
Nice. Well, I'm 30 years young, entrepreneur, hunter. When I'm not working, I'm hunting, and when I'm not hunting, I'm a jazz fan, so that kind of sums me up in a nutshell.
And I'm assuming you mean the basketball team Jazz and not the music.
Yeah, NBA. Yeah, Utah Jazz. There you go.
I was just picturing you with jazz hands right now. So.
But no, that's not me.
All right, man. So, well, let's see. Well, I guess Spencer Carpenter thinks that Sawyer's gay, so I'm assuming you guys are friends.
Yeah, he's good old friend. Guess you can call him that.
What's up, Zach and Tim? Thanks for showing up. So I'm going to start off. I want to hear a little bit. Why don't you guys go ahead and tell me the story? You guys were on a 30-day adventure, pretty much, right? You guys went from elk hunting in Utah, is that right? To where I met up with you guys in. In New Mexico for the Ibex, correct?
Yeah, we started out on the elk hunt, and Dallas was there the whole time. And then Dallas, I think we came home for 3 or 4 days, and then we packed up and went straight to New Mexico to hunt Ibex.
Yeah, we had about a three-day break in between. I think we were right around 10 days on the elk hunt, and from when we left when we got home, I think we were like 16, 17 days in New Mexico.
Wow.
So about 27 days we were hunting.
That's a long stint, man. I don't think I've ever gone. I think 10 days is the longest I've ever done, straight through. And it's mainly because I just can't take that many days off with the wife and kids and work and all that stuff in a row. If I want to hunt the way I hunt, I go on a lot of different hunts a year, and typically 12 to 15 hunts a year, actually. And I need to do that, unfortunately, to produce 12 shows for Days of the Wild. So, but anyhow, I want to hear about the Ibex hunt. You guys, tell me what your sum it up in.
Zach Griffin, take
a paragraph. Hey, Zach. Zach Griffin just popped on with us, and just in time. We're just about to start talking about IBEX.
All right.
So if you can give me a paraphrased description of IBEX hunting, go for it, Devin. Tell me what your thoughts are.
You know, when I first seen that, my first IBEX, I just thought they were majestic, awesome. And then when we actually started going after them, they were no longer, well, they're still majestic, but they're just so squirrely and unpredictable.
That's for sure. That is, that's an understatement. I kind of describe them, I mean, they don't give you, just to give you an idea, I had to come around a boulder on the hunt and expose myself, that sounds funny, I exposed myself to them literally for about 10 yards, and they were 900 yards away, and they busted out of there like I just stepped on one of their big toes or something. It was just like they went, exploded out of there. And I told Hunter, he was following me with the camera. I'm like, listen, man, we're going to go around this boulder. They're going to see us. Even though they're bedded down and they're behind those bushes and they really don't have clear, they're going to see us and they're going to go. Sure enough, they do. I mean, if that was a mule deer, he would have might have looked in our direction and went back to doing what he was doing, you know, and never would have took off. Anyway.
Yeah, we kept... You know, talking about how these ibex have the eye, well, their eyes are better than our 12-power binos, mm-hmm. and no matter what you do, and it makes it tougher to get after these ibex because, like you said, you could be 900 yards going down the hill when you're chasing a mule deer, but with these ibex, you have to go on the backside, which may take you another 30 minutes, 45 minutes to sneak in on these ibex, which is what makes it so difficult when you're putting on a stalk.
Yeah, absolutely. So give me your summary, Sawyer.
You know, going into it, we've hunted mule deer up here. We've hunted elk, and you spot them in the day, you put them to bed, and you make a sneak on them. And I kind of thought that's how it was going to be, and we learned real quick that ibex just don't hold still. They're always doing something. They're always feeding somewhere. And so it was tough. We'd go into it, we'd find them, and we'd make a game plan, and it would take us 2.5-3 hours to get into there. And all of a sudden, they were on the other side of the mountain just from feeding that direction. So that was kind of fun, learning which way they'd feed. And you think you had them figured out, and just when we thought we had them, something would totally change. Something would freak out. You know, one would fall, a rock would slip, and they'd just run the opposite way. So it was kind of fun playing that guessing game, learning a total new animal. So.
And, Dallas, what's your take?
Oh, I mean... I love ibex hunting. I mean, everyone kind of has their own animal, and I love sheep hunting. You know, sheep hunting for me is kind of the pinnacle of hunting, in my opinion. And honestly, I really think ibex is almost another step up from sheep. They both live in difficult terrain,
yeah.
But I really feel like ibex take it to the next level of, you know, steepness and sheer vertical cliffs, the stuff they live in.
Sheep are nowhere near as athletic as ibex are.
Yeah, I mean definitely, you know, more times than not, I think, compared to sheep hunting, I mean, I feel like there were multiple times a day I was honestly, like, scared of the stuff we were scaling, just to, you know, get in position or just to get somewhere where we could even glass, and just such, you know, I think there's as much technical climbing in ibex hunting is just about any animal there is out there.
Oh, seriously. You should probably take a course in rappelling if you really, really want to be a really good ibex hunter. we got into some hairy stuff, and this time around, I did not hunt on the bigs. I think we only hunted on the bigs 2 days. And even on the littles, I mean, you get into some stuff where it's just like, dude, where's my rig? I mean, there was a couple of times, you know, I got some serious vertigo, and I was like, oh, what am I doing? I got a wife and 3 kids at home, and is it really worth me shooting this thing? And I'm like, you know, I had to rethink what I was doing. So,
yeah, for sure.
So, Zach, I wore a flat brim hat to you. What's your take on the ibex hunt? Give me your short and synopsis.
Ditto. That's as short and as sweet as I can get it, buddy. They said everything that I could possibly expound. I mean, it's all there. They're an absolute pain in the ass. They're absolutely addicting. And the more you fail at it, the more a guy with any type of, you know, spine slash balls is going to get more and more committed and more frustrated with not tagging one. And so I look at it like a drug or something. You're addicted to harvesting one, but you probably are never going to be satisfied. I mean, I told Devin, yeah. I mean, all skill aside, you could take any capable, competent archer who's got, you know, the physicality, he's got the bow skills, he knows how to play the wind, whatever. All that aside, luck is 99% of that. You have to have ability to get in a place that you can kill him, and you have to have him hold still long enough for your arrow to fly through the air and hit him in the vitals. And then if all of that works out, you got to recover him.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it's off a 200-foot cliff face or tracking blood on vertical cliffs. I mean, it doesn't make any sense to hunt him with a bow, and that's why we're all doing it.
Right. Right, Actually, I don't think it would be that hard of a hunt. As long as you can hike, I don't think it would be a hard hunt if it was a rifle hunt. Especially if you could shoot.
No, it has to be really fun with a gun.
Yeah, I think it would be, you know, just one of those things to be like picking out the one that you want to shoot type scenario, you know?
Exactly.
It's just getting in bow range and dealing with those steep angles and stuff.
Well, I mean, I don't know if you guys heard this, but I heard with the rifle, the success rate is around 70%. Isn't that what Justin was telling us, Dallas?
Yeah, I believe so.
Or it could have even been higher with a rifle, and then you like look at archery, and you have a 2-5% success rate.
Yeah, it's up there. I know it's up there. But honestly, I think, like I said, the only thing that keeps it that it's not 100% success rate is the physicality, because some people can't hunt. By the time of year that you are rifle hunting, they've been hunted already, and they tend to not hang out on the outside edges. They go into the more inner canyons and stuff, so you have to hike to get to them. I don't think it'd be a terribly hard hunt for me, at least in my opinion. Because, I mean, think about how many times you guys got within, you know, 200, 300 yards of an ibex. So it's not that hard if you're sneaky enough, if you're a sneaky asshole. But we got a couple of questions that came across. One was, how many snakes did you guys see?
What did we kill, 10?
Oh, the snake?
Somewhere around there?
Yeah, I mean, I personally seen 5.
Yeah.
So we were somewhere 10 to 15.
We only had one a day. Yeah, I was really poor. And you know what? Last year on my hunt, I only had one a day. When I went and helped out my buddy the October before, I saw a bunch. Like, I mean, I don't really remember how many, like 12 or something like that in a matter of 4 or 5 days that I helped them.
Did you guys ever have any of these snakes strike at you?
No, I did not.
Zach, did you?
Oh, I don't know if we lost Zach or not.
Oh, we might have lost him, but...
Yeah,
I thought...
Come on, sorry, guys. I had you muted. I got bit in the snake traps probably 3 or 4 times. They were tiny rock rattlers. They're probably 12 inches long. And I was telling Devin, I mean, it felt like someone had just took their knuckle and tapped my shin with it. But I brushed them up, and then the only time I really thought I was in trouble, there was a Mojave on the south side, a green one, and I've heard they chase you, and dude, that bastard chased me for 50 yards. It was unreal how much he came at me, and he would not stay in the open, he'd stay in brush, so only thing I could hear was his rattle, and that was in the middle, like maybe like 10 o'clock at night coming out one night. I mean, I freaking hated him, and I was telling all those guys to get gatored up if you're going to go hunt it.
Right. You know, see, it's funny because I talked to the, I don't remember, I think it's one that night that I met you, Devin, we were talking to, now his name slips my mind, the fish and game warden.
Justin.
Justin, yes. Justin was saying that they didn't have Mojave down there. He said it was just, and I was unsure of that because I had heard from other people that there were, and I think actually Zach had said it at one time that there was Mojaves down there. and I don't remember who else it was, but I've only personally seen Diamondbacks and Rock Rattlers, mostly Rock Rattlers, a little, you know, little black and green ones. We videoed one up real up close, and he didn't even, that's the thing, all the ones we saw didn't rattle. They didn't make a sound. They were just sat there quietly. And when I was out there, and Tanner just reminded me, he just put a post. We almost stepped on one right after I shot mine. We were covering it, and we almost stepped on one. And then the next day, we were filming and trying to help out Kiowa get their last client. An ibex, and we came across another one that we almost stepped on. So we almost got, you know, in a hairy situation. But other than that, I'm so used to walking around here in Arizona. There's a lot more down there, I believe, but you know, that I'm always just looking for them, scanning for them. So I never really had an issue. But
John, did you wear snake gaiters?
You know what? I didn't. I brought them with me, and they kept annoying the shit out of me, kept riding up on the backside.
Yeah.
And I have those turtle skin ones. You know, they're supposed to be softer and comfortable, more comfortable. It kept letting crap go down the back of my boot, because I wear like a three-quarter boot. I don't wear like real high boots, and that was just driving me insane. So finally I said, you know what, I'm not doing it, you know. I said, I'll take my chance. I was more worried about putting my hands when I was climbing up rocks and stuff. Then you're stepping on one, you know, because you see where you're putting your feet most of the time, and you don't see where you're putting your hand. And that's what was freaking me out. I was like, I'm going to get freaking shot in the hand over here. There was a couple of times, you know, where you're just like, you know, Spider-Man and up the wall or whatever, and you're like, crap, I hope there's not a snake in that hole that I'm sticking my hand into, you know.
Oh, yeah, we wore them the first 4 or 5 days, and then Dallas and I were just like, these are too hot, they're noisy, it's hard to sneak in.
Oh, they're noisy as hell.
So after that, we threw them away. But, I mean, I remember that first morning hiking up, and after hearing all the stories, Zach had told me how he'd been struck by a couple of rattlesnakes and how many he would see. I mean, I'm hiking up, this is the first morning going after ibex, and it's dark, and I hear what sound like a rattlesnake, and I chuck my bow, which I have no idea why I did that on the first day, into the bushes thinking that it was a rattlesnake. And Dallas is like, what's going on? I'm like, dude, there's a rattlesnake in that bush. And Zach did a good job on scaring me with these snakes, and yeah, it was a total fake out, and yeah, I felt like an idiot. And I said, hey, Dallas, I hope my bow is all right. He's like, I'm sure it is. Let's keep going.
Yeah, yeah.
And then it wasn't long after that. It was that same morning. I almost stepped on one in the dark.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And so you threw your bow at that one, and then I almost stepped on one. So we were pretty jonesed up the first day. We were like, oh crap, you know.
Yeah, it's because they're there, man. And there's people that guys I'll see 2-3 a day, and then you know other times you'll go like me and get you know an average of one a day or whatever. So, but. Yeah, so I want to know why, I probably already know the reason, but when you were there, you passed up a couple of shots. Let's talk about these shots that you passed up.
Well, the first one was day two, and Dallas and I just got done going after a couple ibex that it just didn't happen. But there was a straggler that was behind, and he was coming up at 70 yards. And this is day two, and he's a nice ibex. We guessed him to be at 30. What did you think, Dallas? Like 32 inches?
Yeah, we said 32, and then later some people that we sent pictures to said 35. So you know, somewhere in that range.
Yeah, I saw that you sent me you sent it to Jake, and I looked at it. Yeah, I think it was 35.
And that's a respectable ibex, but I think for me, it was day two. Yeah, I mean, it was day two, and I didn't want my hunt to end at day two. I mean, it was just – I just felt like we hadn't even really hunted yet.
Mm-hmm.
And plus, I wanted to go for one of those big, mature billies that you can tell that they're mature just because they have that lighter gray, like really cool-looking coat.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, we passed on him. And then what was it, like another 2 or 3 days later, he comes back walking up into that same cave that he was bedded in, and we had another opportunity to shoot at him. But, again, I just wanted one of those bigger, older, lighter-colored, mature billies.
Yeah, I think the second time, I want to say you passed up a 60-yard shot that time. That was the, you know, you definitely would have had a solid shot on that second opportunity.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, when you guys checked Jake that day, I was like, tell him you don't pass. You don't pass like that. You know, I mean, really, at 35, he would have made top 10, you know, SEI or Arctic.
Yeah.
You know.
I mean, I've had a lot of guys ask, you know, do you regret passing on that Ibex? And now here I am sitting in my office. I mean, I can truly say I don't regret it one bit. We did have an opportunity to kill one of those bigger, older, mature Ibex. And, you know, when it came down to it, my execution wasn't on point, and you know, that part didn't happen. So I had my chance because I did pass. And, you know, like most guys say, if you shoot the small ones, you can't kill the big ones.
That's true. That is true. Yeah, I had some opportunities. I missed twice. The first shot, and it was about the same size, about 30, you know, mid-30s Ibex. It was the second to last night. I had passed up a 30-incher the day before at 55 yards. And I was kicking myself in the ass because I knew I only had six and a half days to hunt. I didn't have the full 15 days. So that was on the evening of day four. So, and on day five, I missed in the evening. I had super steep shot. The holdover was 38. And the line of sight was like 90-something, like 96 or something like that. It was stupid.
Wow.
It was crazy. And the wind was blowing right at me. And, like, it hit me until after the fact that the wind's coming at me. I'm shooting straight down like this, so the wind's hitting at the arrow, you know, the whole time and blowing it, you know, towards the mountain. So it was going to hit low. And I hit right at his feet, and his sparks went flying, you know, and they went flying out of there, and it was just one of those things. And then on the evening of the sixth day, I had another opportunity, similar scenario, about the same size Billy, and the holdover was 31, and it was like 68 yards or 70 yards. But I had a small window to shoot through some cedars, and I hit a branch, and I was like, son of a – and I even said it. I said it to the guys on the radio. I go, dude, I'm going to hit this branch. There's no way this arrow's going to clear it because I could see the trajectory. You know, I could see it in my head where it's going to go. Sure enough, it clipped it, and it, like, hit him on the side of the shoulder, like, sideways. The arrow hit him sideways on the side of the shoulder, and he went – and that arrow hit the rock, and it hurt. I heard a ricochet go flying. God knows where the hell that went, but yeah. And so the next morning was just, man, I had like 8 stalks in the mouth. The matter of the half day that we had to hunt, because I had to get out of there by 11 o'clock, get home, because I had to catch a plane to go to New York. But yeah, it was pretty crazy.
So, John, were you – I mean, when you left to New York, you went out there to go hunt whitetails, right?
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, looking back on it now, I mean, were you wishing that you would have skipped out on the whitetail hunt to continue your Ibex hunt, or did you have no choice but to go to New York?
Well, for one, it's my family trip every year. I take my kids and my wife, and we go to New York because that's where I'm from, obviously, if you can't hear my – and she's from there, too. So, we go – We went to see her grandmother out on Eastern Long Island. So it's a family trip, so I couldn't, you know. But to be perfectly honest with you, I end up shooting a buck that I had been after for the last 4 years. A buck we call Swamp. We call it Swamp Donkey. And, you know, he had been giving me the slip, and it was just such – vindication felt like. It felt so good. I haven't had a really good season this year. I feel like I've been taking the consolation prize home every hunt. And coming off such an awesome season last year where I sold 12 out of my 15 tags, you know, this year was just like, ugh, it's just not going my way. I just needed a win, and that was just like one of those things just, you know, put me back up where my brain needed to be, and, you know, put me in cloud nine. And so, yeah, I wasn't regretting until the day after I shot the buck, and then I wanted to fly back to New Mexico because I knew I had some days there. But no, I had a great time in New York, and it's funny. Normally, so I get two buck tags there. I didn't even hunt after I shot him. I was just like, you know, I felt like I did what I needed to do, you know, and I didn't think I was going to find a buck bigger than him. So I was like, oh, whatever's, you know, 140s or 150s that are running around the woods over there, I'll let them live, and hopefully he can grow up to be 160s, 170s, you know?
Yeah, no, that's there's nothing cooler than following a buck for several years. So how old did you think that buck was?
Well, we aged him at 7. So
okay.
The first time I had seen him, he was like a 125-ish, 130-ish buck at 3 years old. And I have a picture of him from the stand in 2014 where he was at his biggest, actually, because he got hit by a car. Well, at least that's what I'm surmising, because I don't think it was an arrow wound. He's got a big scar on his shoulder, and he has a limp. And he got that in 2014, and I saw him with that then, and so I just assumed it was a car accident. He got hit by a car. And after that, he lost probably about 15 inches. He was wider and longer. He did keep the mass. The point configuration all stayed the same. But he definitely, I mean, I'll post a pic. Actually, matter of fact, I'll post it on this comment right now.
Cool.
Oh, it won't let me do it. We'll let you put picture comments on a live feed, apparently. I'll post it up later. You can see him. He's clearly bigger in this picture. I mean, the width and the length is just at least 15 inches. But either way, I'm super happy with him, man. I'm just, you know, and I found out, actually, my buddy that I hunt with out there, he's actually my taxidermist in New York. He ended up shooting a 204 after I left.
Wow. On the same property?
About 3 miles away. And I was like crazy. And my other buddy on the same property, I just posted a pic on Instagram yesterday, shot a nice like 140-ish buck with super long brows. It's like he's got like 11-inch brows, right out of the same tree stand, actually, out of my tree stand. So, yeah, it was pretty cool.
What I'm wondering is, mm-hmm. how did you and Zach both draw the Ibex tag 2 years in a row?
Well, I'll tell you right now, simply, I don't know what Zach did. He probably just got ate a lot of Lucky Charms and sleeps with four-leaf clovers. I used my buddy's outfitter number,
uh-huh.
and it puts you into a whole different pool. Basically, the way New Mexico works on their tag system, so specifically for Ibex, and I don't know what the numbers are for, you know, all the other species, but specifically for Ibex, there's 16 tags for out-of-state hunters, and 10 of the 16 or 12 of the 16 tags is for guys who are hunting with an outfitter. So
right.
If there's 1,000 guys putting in for that hunt for those 16 tags, and only 5 of them are putting in with an outfitter, you know what I'm saying? Or 15, 20 are putting in with an outfitter, the rest are putting in to get the tag solo, you know, your chances go from like single digits to, you know, 30-something percent chance of drawing. And
oh,
now
wow.
that I've said that, it's going to ruin it for everybody. But
I shouldn't have asked.
Most outfitters are, don't offer semi-guided or self-guided hunts. And it's not a cheap outfitted hunt for sure. I think most guys are charging $6,000 or something like that. You know, like there's a lot to it. And they got you know what? When you go with an outfitter, they have a crap ton of spotters out there for you. You know, so there's a lot of guys that are employing. I can see why it costs that much, for sure.
Yeah.
You know, and as you guys know, this is something that takes a team. It's not something you're going to go out there, go solo mission, unless you get lucky. Like Zach said, you know, there's a big luck factor. If you get lucky and one makes a mistake, and you know, I can tell you this, it was a lot easier this year for me to get close without having a cameraman over my shoulder the whole time. We tried for 3 days, and then Hunter got sick and he went home. But, you know, it was harder with him. As soon as he went home, and I just attribute it to because he was a smelly bastard, but no, I'm just joking. It's just that much more movement, that much more scent, and, you know, it's a lot harder when you got somebody over your shoulder. So if you could do it with a cameraman, it's even that much more, you know, of a feat, in my opinion. So, but, yeah, it's something you need a team. You need guys out there, you need spotters. Some guy just asked about doing it with a stick bow. You can do it. If you're willing to hunt them, like, ambush style, like a tree stand, you watch them and kind of, people say there's no pattern to them, but there is. They have some habits. They have some, things that they do that are habitual. And there are travel corridors. And, you know, my buddy BJ Trujillo, he's killed two on the bigs. He just got his on the last day here, his second one. He's found really nice trails way up top, you know, by a cabin or whatever. There's really good trail systems. And if you're willing to sit, you know, 5 days without seeing a goddamn thing, hoping that something passes by, you can do it that way. I thought many times last year, there's this one place that we call the bench, that if I just sat up there like a tree stand, eventually one of them is going to walk by me. And actually, that's where I ended up killing mine, but, I mean, I didn't sit there like a tree stand, but I knew that had I sat there for a long enough time, because I saw beds, I saw the scat, I saw the trails. And if you're a detail-oriented person and you can put those things together, you could definitely hunt them like that. So.
Yeah, that'd be impressive. Do you guys know of anybody that's killed an ibex on that mountain with a recurve or a longbow?
No. And not to say that there hasn't, but not that it's been publicized, not that I know of.
I almost think in a way it might be an advantageous thing because, you know, Tim Wells, he kind of talked to me about it. He said, you guys spend so much time ranging and guessing shots. He goes, I just pull back and fling. And he goes, I think that I could get two arrows off before you fired one. And everyone here knows now that time is everything. You probably have 4 to 5 seconds to shoot because they will always see you somehow.
It's a drive-by shoot.
Yeah, a trad bow. You might just say, hell, dude, hold a foot over his back, let it rip, and just clank. I mean, that might be all it takes.
Right.
I mean, I bet you Dallas could do it. You got to get a guy that knows how to shoot one really well. But, yeah, I think it could be ninja status. That might be the way to do it.
Well, you know, so the one that you guys, whether you saw seen my video or not, my film or not, but I shot one in the face last year, and I was 26 yards. I was 26 yards from him. And had I had my recurve, because it was one of those, he was running, you know, I'm actually very good at shooting things out of the air and, you know, shooting things on the run with my recurve because I practice on coyotes and stuff like that because it's always like a drive-by shooting with those guys. You know, they come running into the call and, you know, you got a half a second to draw and shoot. I practiced that. Last year, I mean, I was practicing 3D like crazy. You know, I got to the point where I was shooting, an arrow every 5 seconds, basically, with great accuracy out to 50 yards, you know. And you just got to practice that over and over and over and over and over again. And people are like, oh, but you're going to develop target panic and this and that, and you know. And I've had this argument with everybody a bunch of times. I'm like, you know what? Any real hunter that knows that's hunted, when you're in that position, it's target panic. Hunting an animal is target. Very rarely do you have the time to draw back and sit there and talk yourself through your steps, and you know, it just doesn't always happen that way. Most of the time, it's like, especially if you like hunt the rut and stuff like that, you know, deer's chasing a doe and you step through your one opening and you know you got 4 seconds before he starts to trot after that doe again to draw back and let it go. You know, ibex are 8 times worse. So, but
So, do you guys, I mean, they say that this hunt with a bow is the hardest hunt in North America after hunting them.
Mm-hmm.
Do you guys believe that?
So far, they were the hardest thing that I've ever hunted. Yeah, but I haven't gone mountain goat hunting yet. I'm about to go on my first sheep hunt. Well, I've been on sheep hunts, but it's the first time I'm going to be the hunter. So, yeah, I think so. Yeah, I believe.
Dallas, you've done a lot of hunting the last 6, 7, 8 months. What's your thoughts?
Well, the thing is, I don't know. Some of the sheep hunts can be pretty grueling. They're grueling in a different way. I would say that nothing is more, you know, technical than hunting ibex, and I'd say that nothing's spookier than ibex. But, I mean, on some of these sheep hunts, you know, if you're carrying a 75-pound backpack with you 24/7, that, you know, can
more
be
physical.
Super, super physically tough. But, I mean, as far as – I think really the game changer of the two is bow hunting them. Because I went in February, I actually went over to Turkey and hunted the same kind of ibex, you know, in there. Native land, I guess you could say.
Right.
And it's funny because it was very, very similar. Super steep, the rocks, I mean, they tore up my boots just as bad as the Floridas did.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the thing, not only did the rifle and bow set it apart, I mean, the bow hunting was ridiculously difficult, but with this early hunt especially, in Turkey I was there in the winter, and we were hunting the Floridas in the summer, and man, I don't think there's anything more draining than heat. When you've got a hike in, you know, high 80 degree weather with a pack and going uphill, I mean, that really, for me personally, the heat really just sucks the energy right out of you.
Yeah, being hot. I've been on the January hunt, and it's a whole different ball game. Like, you can go and go a lot longer. It's because you're not dying of the heat. BJ just posted that Carlo Molina is a local guy in Deming has killed one with a longbow. So
yeah, that's the guy we met down there.
Yeah, old Carlo.
Yeah,
he's a stud.
Apparently, he is the Superman.
And he actually killed three down there, right?
I want to say, yeah, 3 or 4.
Yeah, that's awesome.
For sure, 3.
Yeah, I think it's like anything else. If you learn the habits and you learn the species of what they do, their behavior and all that stuff, it's something that you could probably kill every year. I mean, obviously you got to draw the tag, but because let's face it, there's a crap ton of them on that mountain. I think what makes sheep hunting so hard is that you spend half the time looking, more than half, 75% of the time looking and maybe, you know, 25% of the time stalking.
Yeah.
Where it's the other way around. You spend about 25% of the time looking for ibex. At least that's been my experience. I don't think I ever had any hard time finding one. It's just finding one in a spot to go after is a different story. But seeing them, you know, and just the sheer fact that you're seeing them gives you motivation to, you know, keep on going, you know. It gets hard. You go 3 days and you haven't seen a sheep. And you're like, what the, you know, what's going on here? I got to hike up this mountain again, and I haven't seen crap. But like I said, I've never been the mountain goat hunting, so that, from what I understand, especially because of the altitude, the 13,000s and whatever that they occupy, makes that a super, and the low numbers again, makes that a super difficult hunt. But the actual animal itself is pretty easy. They're pretty tolerant of, you know, movement and smell. And this is just, you know, given to me secondhand, so I don't know 100%. I know that sheep sometimes are super spooky, and other times if you're below them, if you get the craps that you're there. I went scouting, and just for shits and giggles, I just walked up and kind of, you know, half-ass snuck and got 7 yards from a, you know, a class 3 ram and videoed him. And he didn't give a crap that I was there, because as long as he was above me, he knew he had the, you know, at least he felt that he had the advantage. And Ibex don't do that. They don't care. They see you, unless you're on the floor or in the truck or whatever, and they, you know, they can see you, you know, glassing up at them from, you know, several thousand feet or whatever, 7,000 yards. As soon as they see you on the same mountainside as them, they're gone. So I think that's what makes them. They have no tolerance for human beings at all. So,
Zach, would you have done anything different on your hunt, or John, would have done anything different? Now that you look back, I mean, you did kill your first year, so that's a success. What about if you look back this year, or Zach, if you look back, would have done anything different in order to, you know, connect on a goat?
Well, for myself this year, I wasn't in the same shape that I was last year. And like I said, that kind of limited me. I was hunting the dragon and I was hunting the littles mostly because I knew my ass wasn't going to hike up and down every single day on the bigs. In hindsight, I probably could have rented a razor or something like that and drove up the canyon and hung it from the top down. The thought crossed my mind, but really, no, man. I learned so much from the guys at Kiowa, and from my own experiences, you know, having gone out there and helped other guys, that I feel like I'm adequate enough that right now, if I wanted to start my own Ibex hunting guide, I probably could. Not to sound like a cocky, but I feel like I know enough about them, and I probably could be pretty successful. I really feel that if I was there for another 2 days and didn't leave after day 6, that I would have gotten it done. I may not have gotten a giant, but I would have definitely taken home at least one that was a similar caliber to one I shot last year. So, what about you? You feel like you would have done something different?
Oh man, I feel like we hunted them. I mean, I wish we could have scouted before. So I thought, heck, we're gonna have 15 days. So I thought that'd be plenty to get it done. But the one thing I wish I would have done is when I had my shot at, I mean, this was the second to last day of the hunt. When I had my shot, the one thing I wish I would have done is pull all my arrows out of my quiver, because my bow is like, it's really quiet when I don't have my arrows in my quiver.
Okay.
And then when I took my shot, my bow, which I knew it, we even talked about it. Dallas and I were sitting behind a cliff waiting for this. This was another goat that was coming out that we decided to pass on once he did come out. Mm-hmm. And we took all my arrows out so we could have that quiet shot, because these things are just so spooky. And they're aware. They're always looking for you.
Right.
But, yeah, I wish I would have pulled out my arrows, because I believe my bow would have been much quieter. And at that point, I don't think he would have dodged my arrow like you did.
Yeah. You know, they've done a lot of research about that, about them jumping the string, so to speak. You actually need to take a look at the arrows themselves.
Right.
They did this study in Africa, and I can't remember who did it. It wasn't Boddington, but it was one of those guys that's a big writer and whatever. But there were the animals at the waterhole, and they would shoot at a target in the direction that the animals were at. And they would all bust, like, right as they let go of the shot. And then they would put a target behind them, and they were shooting at the target through the backside, and the animal didn't even flinch. So the sound of the bow going off wasn't what made them jump. That is actually
right.
The sound of the arrow probing through the air that makes them react. And actually, you know who told me about that was Tim Gillingham. I had him on my podcast like 4 years ago. That's actually on my YouTube, guys, if you want to check that out. And we talk about that in great detail. They had all this testing that using fletching that doesn't make as much noise and so on and so forth. It's not actually the string that they're jumping or the sound of the bow. My personal opinion is I think it's a little bit of both, but it's definitely I stopped using lighted knocks because I can see deer catching the light and tracking that arrow and dodging it more effectively than if I wasn't shooting it. So,
yeah, I had a guy hit me up on Instagram saying that same thing. So that makes perfect sense. So is it more of the fletching or is it more of the broadhead?
I think it's the fletching. Well, it could be both. And I'm not going to start bashing on broadheads, but I know for one, like a G-Tech Montech or G5 Montech, those things whistle. If you have ever had a guy shoot past you, like, stand off your range or whatever and have it shoot, that thing whistles when it's going by you. And I have to imagine that there are a lot of other broadheads that do that. I've checked my setup, and it's not the quietest. The quietest I ever got it was with the AAE. And they're actually called quiet vanes. They believe in the same technology, too. But I didn't like the way they flew for me. And they didn't stabilize the broadhead good enough, so I took accuracy over quietness any day. But I shoot Schwackers, and they don't seem to make – the broadheads don't seem to make noise. But I shoot blazer vanes, and blazer vanes are kind of noisy. Yeah.
Yeah, I'll have to go back and check my setup now.
Yeah, I mean, I always tell people that all the guys that are the most successful out there are all the guys that have pay attention to the details. You know, those are the guys that get it done, and you seem like a real detail-oriented guy. I mean, the fact that you're asking about this, you know, other people don't like to ask about that stuff. And that
I would imagine that your setup was super quiet, Devin, because you were shooting – I want to say you've got AAE vanes on yours, and they're about half the height of a blazer. And with that mechanical broadhead on the front, I mean, the surface area off your arrow is about as small as I think you can get.
Yeah, I had Towson over there at Zeiss Archery. He built my arrow, you know, for this Ibex hunt. And I leaned on him for the technical part. So, yeah, I think you're right. I wonder if it was my mechanical broadhead just because it was the four blade mechanical. Now, I don't know if that's it. I'm going to certainly go test it and find out. But what I do know for sure is when I left my arrows in my quiver, it was just loud, and I wish I really, really would have pulled my arrows out. Yeah.
I think it's a bit of both. I mean, you could definitely get a lot of noise out of the bow, you know, and people have been saying it for years, so I don't discount it by any means because I think, you know, you got a quiet bow, you got a noisy bow, they're gonna hear it. We got a couple of questions real quick. Dakota asked, what physical and mental prep do you go through to prepare yourself for Ibex hunt? I'll let you know what I did. I want to hear what Devin did for his.
Physical and mental prep. You know, I don't know if I did
a 10-day elk hunt.
Yeah, I think what
15 days elk hunt. That you did. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, for me, I mean, I love being out there. I love the challenge, and yeah, I do go through these, you know, the where it gets to you mentally, and maybe you don't want to go up, or you want to sleep in, or you want to take the easy route. But in my mind, if I take the easy route, I'm always beating myself up. So when I wake up and I do sleep in or we take the easy route, I'm always wishing that we would have gone the extra mile. And if I don't go the extra mile, then it's almost like painful for me to even think about that. But you're right, Dallas. Like, I mean, for me, I'm always hunting. You know, the elk hunt definitely helped. If I wasn't elk hunting, I would have been hitting the deer. You know, I've been going after deer pretty hard. So I think it's just a consistently for me of always going and always doing it. Right. And if I don't give it 110%, then I'm always beating myself up. So that's what keeps me going.
Well, I did a lot of, for last year, I did a lot of prep. This year I couldn't. I had a son in March, my third child, and being 40 years old, I'm older than you guys. That took a lot out of me. You know, the not sleeping and whatnot. But last year, I trained like a madman. I was in the gym all the time, so, you know, physically getting ready. But most of my preparation were with bow in hand. I did a lot of shooting under pressure, running, taking shots. Like I said earlier, taking moving shots. I did a lot of super steep angle. That's, you know, you have to practice deep angle shots. Because I don't know if you were listening in the early part of the podcast, I was telling you about how I missed, and my shot was 90 some odd yards, 92, 3 yards, something like that, and my holdover was only 38. So you can imagine what kind of an angle I was shooting at, you know, 70 degree angles and you know, stuff like that. So that stuff it's a must, because your bow is going to shoot, is going to operate differently. You start messing with your anchor points and how your body is. I mean, it's crazy. That's where my prep was. I've always practiced for years and years and years. I practiced getting shots off fast and reloading. And so that one that I shot in the face, you don't see it in the video. I shot him in the face, reloaded and shot again before he crested. And I didn't hit him, I guess. But, you know, that's the kind of stuff that I practice. That's the stuff I think you need to practice for this type of hunt. It's that type of scenario. And I did kind of what Devin did. I went and hunted elk in Colorado at 12,000 feet, you know, for a week before I went out there. So to get my lungs as strong as I can get them, I guess, before I went out on this hunt. So, but yeah, I want to hear about the cemetery bus before we go here, because we're getting on to an hour. And I've never actually talked to you about it, and I know there's a lot of guys out there. Heck, I put your picture out there with that buck, and I put, you know, the details of this podcast, and there was probably 400 likes, and not a single person was even paying attention to what the wording was. It's like, okay, I'm trying to tell you, we're going to talk to this guy that shot this thing, you know? And they're like, awesome buck, you know? And then there's a couple douchebags out there were like, his arms are, yeah, whatever.
Well, I'll let Dallas set the stage, and then I'll give you the short version of the hunt real quick.
All right.
But Dallas, fill everybody in on the cemetery buck and who he is.
Well, I used to go take pictures of this buck. He lived in downtown Salt Lake in the cemetery, and I mean, just a famous deer that kind of everyone who likes big mule deer had seen this buck. I mean, you could drive down to the cemetery. I don't think you're supposed to go in there, but we'd all drive in there, and I mean, I want to say I don't know exactly. Wouldn't you say he was right around 200 inches for a few years in there?
Yep.
200 or over, and I mean, you could drive up, you know, within 50 yards, and I mean, how often do you get to do that, you know, drive up and see a 200-inch mule deer? I mean, he was a giant buck, and everybody knew about him. And then one day, I think everyone just assumed that's where he lived all year. I mean, that's what I assumed. And one day a rumor got out that someone had shot the buck, and Devin,
Someone had taken a picture of a spotting scope with the hunter and a fish and game officer, kind of from a distance, I think, with a phone scope or something, over the buck. So obviously the person who had shot the buck was, you know, called the fish and game so they could come up and, you know, see that it was legit. You know, it wasn't killed in the cemetery. It was killed up, you know, on the mountain in the unit. And I don't know how he did it, but Devin kept it hush for, I think a solid year before, you know, he finally let the cat out of the bag and published the big article, and you know, everyone was stoked. But there's definitely an awesome story behind that buck, because it is not what people think it was. And I'll let you tell the story of when you found him, Devin, and how long it took you to get him.
So what I thought was so neat about this buck is he did live in the cemetery most of the year. He, you know, from what I understand, he actually left maybe 1 year during when he had velvet, but then he came back. But every year during the rut, he would leave the cemetery, go up a couple miles up onto the benches of the Wasatch Front, and then he would spend all of November up there rutting does. And then when he would get done, he would head back and go back to the cemetery, which is where he spent most of his time and where he lived. But what's really cool about this buck that I thought is that year I was hunting him, there was 2 to 3 guys up there every single day. If not every single day, there was at least 1 or 2 guys up there every single day. And somehow, with all of this pressure, the cemetery buck managed to survive, you know, the 3 to 4 years that he spent up there. Now, I only hunted him that 1 year, and I found him around November 2nd or 3rd, and I hunted him for 24, 23 straight days, something like that. But it was getting close to the hunt, and I just thought to myself, if I didn't get lucky that one day, I mean, this buck would have lived another year surviving, outsmarting all of these hunters and all the pressure up on the Wasatch Front. But with the help of good friends and glassing and spotting, my buddy was up there that day, the day that I was able to connect. But he had to go to work, so he's like, okay, Devin, he's going up the way he usually does, and he would cross this hill. But my buddy had to leave, so I went down and sat where he would usually cross over, just thinking, well, maybe he's going to cross through. And luck would have it, he's coming over the ridge, and he skylines himself, and all of a sudden I can see 230 inches of solid bone coming over the ridge.
Wow.
I start shaking. I'm thinking, okay, this is going to happen. This is going to happen, and all he needs to do is take the higher trail, and I'm going to get a shot. Luckily, he takes the higher trail. I pull back my bow. I'm sitting behind a tree, and he's walking. He looks down, and I release, and it was over from there. But it was fun, and I thought, you know, before I killed him, I thought, if I kill him, this is going to be cool, and you know, I want to be able to show everybody. But it was just a different feeling that when it actually happened. Yeah. I just thought, you know what, I'm just going to keep this between me and my buddies, and if it gets out, it gets out, and then that picture got out. But, that buck was something special to be able to live through all that pressure and being hunted. I mean, I've even got a buddy, Kip, who he actually missed him the year before.
Oh, wow.
So just an awesome, awesome, awesome deer. And just, he's cool.
Well, if you think about it, I mean, where that buck was living is, I mean, in the winter, it is a heavily bow hunted area. And I would say, you know, that deer survived, you know, 100, between those 2 years, I mean, that deer survived 100 days of high pressure bow hunting.
Oh, yeah.
At least. And I mean, Devin, I mean, wasn't the craziest thing you were telling me is, I mean, you've killed a few 200-inch bucks with your bow. Didn't you say that was one of the smartest deer you've ever hunted?
Oh, for sure. And I hate saying that because people, you know, may assume that I'm just saying that because it's the cemetery buck and I want to make him sound smarter than what he really is. But, I mean, there were guys, like I said, after him every day, there were guys going in where they shouldn't be hunting him. Because he was right on the border of a canyon that you can't hunt. And he would go in there and he would come out and he would bed 100 yards across the border where you can't where you can't hunt, and I just felt like he knew he was safe.
Yeah.
And, yeah, you could go into the cemetery. I mean, I drove in the cemetery with my wife and my dog, and he's right outside our window at 15 yards. But
right.
he knew the difference between living in the cemetery and the pressure on the mountain.
Oh, yeah.
And I don't know how he knew that, but he knew where he was safe and where he wasn't. And my argument would be, is it, if he's as tame as what people think, which is fine, it's an opinion and I don't want to argue that, but if he's as tame as what some people think, which he was in the cemetery, you know, how was he so smart to survive those 100 days like Dallas talked about, which is why I thought he was such a cool buck.
Yeah. You know, people say, and you know what? I guarantee you none of the whitetail hunters in the East Coast or in the Midwest would be arguing with you that he's not the smartest buck you ever hunted. Because, you know, whitetail do that all the time. They know how to find sanctuary. Then they know, they get accustomed to what is a safe zone for them. And once they leave that safe zone, they know, hey, I need to be on edge. You know, he probably didn't even have any natural predators inside the cemetery. But I bet you when he got on the mountain, he knew he had to watch his ass for mountain lions.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And it's funny. It sucks that you had to, you know, be, you know, kind of persecuted, you know, for shooting such a great animal. We lost the connection here for a second. Got it. Came back. I kind of felt that way. I wasn't going to tell anybody that I drew this Ibex tag this year. And I didn't until I was already there for 2 days and a couple people had seen my truck. You know, it's kind of hard to hide a, you know, big Chevy Silverado with stickers all over the side of it. And kind of blew me up on Facebook, and I was like, oh, shit, the cat's out of the bag. I might as well, you know, ride the wave. But I wasn't going to tell people because so many people ruined that experience for me. I shot a freaking Ibex with my bow. I shot two with my bow last year. Okay, I didn't recover one, but I shot two. And the only thing anybody could ever say was, well, you know, Kyla Honey was helping you. You know, Kyla was helping you out. So, you know, you had a guide. Okay. All right, man. Tell me one. I mean, go there, and I will guide for you. I will bring it, and you tell me. You guys know. You guys want to. Doesn't matter how many eyes you got out there telling you which way to go and whatever. It's still a super tough hunt, and you know it just sucks how social media and people out there, there's so many haters and there's so many people that are jealous that don't want to let you enjoy the accomplishment that you did. There's so many times, man, that I just want to throw my hands up and say, screw the camera, screw, you know, all this whatever, you know, and just go and hunt. But,
oh, yeah. Yeah, I agree.
It sucks that people try to take that away from you and say, oh, you shot a pet. Well, obviously that pet made it through. How old was that buck? 8? 9?
I think, 7 or 8, I believe.
Okay. Yeah. He didn't make it that long because he was an idiot.
Yeah.
Especially if he was
going
back and forth. So, you know, I'd say screw everybody, man, and just shout out.
Yeah, I mean,
Got it from the rooftops,
I mean,
that you did that. So.
After it was all done, I mean, I think like everybody else, I mean, I definitely, you know, I mean, it's kind of weird, but yeah, I was sad because now we have this 230-inch buck living in the cemetery that myself and many others love to go see. So I get it where they're coming from. And yeah, it kind of sucked that next year when I thought, man, I could be checking out the cemetery buck right now and who knows how big he would have been. But yeah, just an awesome deer and so grateful and humbled to be able to have that opportunity to connect on them. But one thing, I don't know if we're getting close to the end, but I do want to say this, Dallas and Sawyer was there spotting. Ryan Tuttle, he was there spotting with us too. And Dallas was there with the camera the whole time, and he got some awesome footage. So what I'm thinking is if everybody can hammer Dallas and motivate him to put this film together, we could all check it out, because the story that he could put together with all of the film and footage we have, which is amazing footage, it's pretty cool, because we work super hard. There's times where I'm excited. There's times when I'm down on my luck and I want to throw my bow off the cliff. And then 2 days before the end of the hunt, I get that shot that Dallas, I, Sawyer, Ryan, and some of the guys that we met from New Mexico that even came down and helped us along the way. Mm-hmm. I finally get my opportunity, 74 yards. I mean, it's everything that we worked so hard for. He's an old goat, mature, big. And I'm thinking, okay, Dallas, this is it. This is it. Dallas is shaking. I'm shaking. And it was just that picture perfect. And then, unfortunately, you can see this in the video, and Dallas will slow-mo it, mm-hmm. that my arrow's going down, and it's halfway in the air, and the goat's still sitting there. And as the arrow goes a little further than halfway, the goat literally leaps off this rock, and my arrow hits. And I need to look at the footage again, but I asked Dallas before. I believe it would have been perfect. I mean, just perfect. And the goat that was behind him, he didn't even move. Mm. So just bad luck. But to me, I mean, it was still a success. And I'm hoping Dallas gets enough pressure that he puts this video together for all of us.
Yeah.
See, that makes me think that whole arrow noise is more viable than the bow noise. Especially
I think we need to do a little more looking into that.
I've been wanting to do it for sure. Hey, this guy, Kellen Cook, just put a post. He said, and I didn't hear this, so this is funny. I usually kind of catch on to this stuff, but said that there was people giving you a hard time about the bull that you killed, too, because it had a tag in the ear.
So this is actually kind of funny, because when I was scouting with some of the guys that live in the area, I don't remember if it was Colin or Kellen, because both those guys, they helped me out, but we had a conversation on how the Hardware Ranch,
mm-hmm.
Well, Sawyer, why don't you explain the Hardware Ranch, because you probably know more about that history than I do on how that works, and I can explain the whole tag in the ear thing.
Yeah, for sure. So where we live up here, we got the Hardware Ranch, and it's a place where during the winter they feed the elk. You can come up, you can ride a sleigh through the herd and see the elk up close.
Mm-hmm.
But just like everything else, they're wild. You know, you can't pet them, you can't do that. And
it's
so
like Yellowstone.
Yeah. So
like
one thing they started doing is they started tagging calves. So when they're a year old, they round some up and they tag them. And then when you kill one, you're supposed to call, and it's no different than tagging a duck or shooting a banded sheep. You know, it's just that kind of thing. And so that's where those come from. They're not super rare, but, I mean, when I shot my cow this year, I wanted to have ear tags. I found one with ear tags.
Yeah.
But, yeah, that's just kind of a thing. It's just the same as banding a duck.
Yeah. Now, I didn't hear anything about it. This is the first thing. Kellen's the first thing that he brought it up, that people were giving him shit about it. And he said everybody.
They must be doing it behind my back, because, I heard a couple comments.
Yeah. You know what, man? Like I said, and Zach and I talked about this on the podcast he did with me. It's just, it's all jealousy, man. Most people that talk crap are just because they can't do what you do. Simple as that. You know, they're not killing the same caliber that you are. They're not killing the same. They might not be killing at all, or they just don't even get a chance to go, and they envy your life that you get to go and do these awesome adventures, and, you know, you're not shoveling shit, you know. So
I was looking forward to the controversy, because I knew how hard we worked and I knew what we put into it. And I actually thought it was going to blow up a lot bigger than what it really did. But, I mean, I know there was a few comments, but I thought for sure we were going to get into some controversy. But that's another film that Dallas was there filming the whole thing that we all need to put pressure on him for, because what's cool about that is Dallas is there filming the whole thing. My dad's there, part of the hunt, and we actually had a rifle tag in our back pocket. And we had all made the commitment that we were going to hunt with a bow till the last 3 days of the hunt. And then, then after that, we'd pull out the rifle. And then it came down to the last day of the hunt, where we were supposed to be pulling out that rifle, and we just said, hey, you know what? Let's leave the rifle back. Let's take the bow. And that's when it all happened. We're 62 yards, and we connected. But yeah, let's all actually. Hey, Dallas, when is that film going to get done anyway?
All right, so I'll explain it. So for the last year, I've been filming for this new project that we're working on, and it's called The Experience. And pretty much what we're doing is just I'm documenting all these hunts with Jason Price and Dan Catlin, and I really feel like in the hunting industry, especially hunts, you know, so many of them are portrayed as just a kill shot, and what we're trying to do is just really document, you know, the whole adventure, the travel aspect, and a lot of these different things, the people that you come in contact with, the different cultures. And so for the last year, I filmed in, you know, Turkey, New Zealand, Alaska, Canada, all over the place. And so we've kind of just been stockpiling up this episode. And the first Alaska episode is going to drop within the next, I think, in about 10 days. And what we're going to do is we've got enough content. We've just been building up content so we can have, you know, steady episodes throughout the whole next year. And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to start them off at I'm kind of going to do the first hunt that was filmed, and then I'm going to go to the most recent one. So we're going to start with Doll Sheep, and then I've got a Texas Audat hunt with Jason next week, and then we're going to do Audat. And then I'm thinking right after that one, we'll do we'll do a moose hunt, and then Devin's episode. So I would guess probably right about the first of the year we'll be dropping. We'll see whether it'll be elk or ibex, when I get that edited up, I'll definitely get you a link, John, and you can share a couple of guns for sure.
Definitely love to see it. Well, man, I guess that's all I got for you guys. I love having you guys on. I'd love to have you guys on individually on the interviews with the masters, a more traditional podcast with you know, specific questions and whatnot. So I'll be hitting you up here probably later in the season. You got any other really interesting hunts coming up, Donnie or Devin? Excuse me, I'm looking at Donnie's.
No, I've been hunting deer pretty hard along the Wasatch Front. That'll go till the end of November.
Mm-hmm.
And then we're trying to make a coos deer hunt workout in Arizona. And then I'll be out in Mexico come January hunting mule deer.
Cool. I'm leaving this weekend for elk hunt here in Arizona, late season bow hunt. It should be kind of a tough hunt, but it should be fun. I'll have a good time. Can't stay the whole hunt. I got to get back early. Only got about 6 days to hunt. I have that, and then I got my sheep hunt in December, and I'll be hunting deer here in January during the rut. Be going to Mexico too for some coos deer hunting. So
where's your sheep hunt at?
It's here in Arizona. You want to come
down?
I'd love to have you. I could use some extra time.
When is it?
It's the whole month of December, but you know, we're going that first week of December. I plan to go the first week of December, and maybe if I don't get it done that first week, come back home for 2-3 days and then go back again and, you know, just go back and forth, you know, 4 days at a time or something. So.
Awesome.
But, yeah. Well, man, thanks for having, thanks for coming on, and it was great to have you on, and I look forward to next time and get you guys one-on-one, like I said, and have a more traditional podcast. I'd like to see how your
awesome.
Season played out. So.
Yeah, thanks for having us on. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks, John.
Yeah, hey, thanks, John.
You're welcome. Thank you. All right, guys. Well, thank you all for joining us on this episode. And, again, I'd like to thank my sponsors, the Outdoor Insiders and Onyx Maps, because without them, I wouldn't be able to do this. And we'll catch you the next time. I'll put this episode up on the, on Podbean here, Podbean probably next week. I have a couple other guests that we're going to release that we have coming up. We have South Cox, Remy Warren, Don Yates, Adam Balestro, a bunch of guys we've already did podcasts with, Ross Moline. I'm going to probably release him next because we're right here in the heart of the whitetail rut in Midwest and northern states. So we talk a lot about whitetail hunting and stuff like that. So, well, thanks again, and we'll see you next time.
Thanks, John.
Thanks, John.
Thanks.